Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility, he knows keeping the line up and running is a top priority. That's why he chooses Grainger. Because when a drive belt gets damaged, Grainger makes it easy to find the exact specs for the replacement product he needs. And next day delivery helps ensure he'll have everything in place and running like clockwork. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to the 40K Lorecast.
Welcome to the 40K Lorecast with me, John Barsotti, and Brad Chester.
This guy.
It's party time, everybody. We are doing it. After 2 years of casting, I finally feel confident enough in our abilities to do the proper justice to the greatest of all the legions, the Ultramarines. Oh, come on. We're doing this.
If we do our lineup of special characters, we could do 73 episodes on them.
Yeah, I did think about that, that if we did, this could just be the next 6 months of our lives, because if we do the named characters, there's over 20 of them, and I think almost all of them have a book. One of them has his own video game. No, two of them have their own video games. It gets a little excessive. So we'll see kind of what we do with this, guys. I think it'll probably be three casts. It might push to four. We'll see. TBD. But anyway, 40K Lorecast, the weekly show in the lore of the Warhammer 40K universe, releasing every Monday at 7 p.m. Please follow and comment on the cast. We are now, again, ranked very well, thanks to all of you, and really appreciate it. The more you guys comment, the more you like, the more it spreads us out to more people, and that's just cool. It makes it fun to be ranked above. There are actually some podcasts I listen to that we are now ranked ahead of, which is, I'll be honest, weird for me, just candidly. If you like the cast, want to hear more of Brad and I, you can either follow our other show, The History of 40K, also available on iTunes, Spotify, etc., or you can also go to our YouTube page, the 40K Lorecast. There you'll find old versions of this show that have been converted over with imagery, live Q&A sessions, the history of 40K, and our new short series, a whole bunch of stuff. So please check it out. In addition, if you like the show and you want to help us out, there's a link to our Patreon. Massive thank you to everyone who's contributed already. The improvements to the show, the expansion, it's because of the Patreon. Our Patreon is $4.99 a month. You get the show ad-free for that rate, or 76.84 Maldivian Ruvia, which is interesting thing about the Maldives. They are the lowest and flattest country on the earth, just like Ohio.
I was, as soon as you said flat, I was waiting for the Ohio jab.
People in Ohio would go, they're like, this is lovely. But the cool thing about Maldives is, for those of you who scuba dive, like myself, it's an incredible place to go. You've got bioluminescent plankton. You've got rich and thriving coral reefs, shark dives, which I actually love to do, and even large aquatic things like the blue whales will come through on occasion.
Did we get sponsored by the Maldives somehow that I don't know about?
No, I told you, we're doing Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego. That's what this is. Every single week I'm doing something. But one note on the Maldives is, if you want to go soon, because the sea levels are rising, and when you are the lowest, flattest place on Earth, it's not great when the water goes up a few inches or centimeters.
Look, anyway. I was just playing some Civ. All you have to do is put the walls around it and you'll be fine.
Yeah. Lastly, though, we also have a link to our Discord in the show notes for those of you who like the show and just want to interact with more stuff around it, especially with some of the new video games that are coming out, some of the new novels coming out. Our Discord is a great place to get advice, help, etc. There's even an entire channel for people who play Space Marine 2 looking for people to game with. So come on in, come on over to it. Brad and I are there all the time. You can ask us questions, tell us the stuff we got wrong. It's going to come up every single episode, probably.
I've never been wrong.
Yeah. But anyway.
I can't wait to hear somebody just rip into me for that one.
But let's have some fun with Blue Space Marines, who, by the way, have always been blue. No change to the armor color.
Whoa. Light blue. Thank you very much.
That's true. So I'm going to warn you all. Everyone has a favorite legion. And my favorite of the recognized legions, I actually do like some like the Carcadons, the Minotaurs, but not really a recognized legion. Of the ones who play on tabletop is the Ultramarines. And it's not, to be fair, because I'm a shill for GW. It's because I was born in the 80s. I like 80s and 90s action dramas where the protagonist always has to pull off the victory at the last second. And that is Ultramarines lore. No matter the odds are in their favor or the enemies, they always win at the very last moment with dramatic flair. And if you don't believe me, go play Space Marine 2 again.
Well, let's just say John's favorite armor is plot armor.
Yeah, it is. I'm actually a shill for bad writing, and I talk a lot of crap on bad writing, but there is something I like about the excitement of, oh no, he's going to fall into the pit of doom. And then he doesn't at the last second. This was the era that gave us like, you know, Indiana Jones. I mean, this is all we saw in our movies in this whole era. Star Wars, where I have to shoot, I can blow up a floating moon of attack with one shot down an air duct. I guess that was the 70s, but still, same general concept.
I'll say. Anyway. Went back a little more. You went back to Brad's time.
Exactly. All right. But originally known as the 13th Legion, but this time 13 is a lucky number. Whereas many other legions showed an aptitude for a specific style of combat, the 13th showed something a lot greater, which was restraint.
I would say not just restraint, I would say versatility.
Yes, that's a much better way of putting it, because the raw power you saw out of like World Eaters, Blood Angels, Iron Warriors, Space Wolves, Death Guard, there is no question in it. But they were all suited really for a specific style of combat. Against more tactical foes, a lot of these like monostylistic legions could be muted or countered because their battle plans just weren't diverse enough. So in order to achieve success, they were partnered with the 13th Legion. And that's how the 13th Legion first began to excel. I'm also going to point something out before I dive into what I'm about to, this diatribe I'm about to go on, everybody. I'm not trying to badmouth the other legions when I do this. This is how GW writes the Ultramarines. So they write all the legions as being the best and the best and the best. And they write the Ultramarines as being, yeah, those guys are the best, but these guys are better. It's just how it is.
The thing about them is, when you talk Marines, the other chapters, the Blood Angels, the Space Wolves, are their own separate thing. When you say Marines, they're almost always referring to the Ultramarines.
Yeah. This is because the Ultramarines were superior in thought and planning above all other legions. They might lose a few sorties against the other legions, but their mastery of tactics and flexibility, they would always win the war. And we see this later, and it'll be in our next episode when we talk about how when the Word Bearers attacked and they got them completely by surprise, and the Ultramarines were able to take their moment, find the weakness, and then exploit it. That's just what the Ultramarines always do. They never lose the war. They may lose the battle. And I'm a huge fan of them because of this, because I think that's what tactics are supposed to be.
Yeah, I like this. It really shows them because they were deployed with everyone. So they were in every mix. Because they were the most versatile, the most easily flexible chapter of any of the Marines. Oh, sorry, legions, not chapters. But they could be sent anywhere because they would send whatever the other people needed in that particular battle. They would send units of Ultramarines that would fill the gap. They were the spackle that you threw on whatever the battle was.
And what I like about this, where again, when we talk about the Ultramarines having plot armor, it is not a joke. They are the way that GW pushes stuff forward. So in the early days of the Great Crusade, the Ultramarines were sent out in small groups to be attached to the other legions as they fought. And in a pretty serious foreshadowing effect, when they would take part in these combats or with other legions, they would then put iconography. I actually don't know how to pronounce that word. Sorry. Iconography. This is my first and kind of only language. There's a lot of words I can't do.
I love it.
But anyway, they would start putting iconography on their armor to commemorate the achievement. The same way military sleeve insignias and service medals exist. We see this more modern day, like with Death Watch. now have this. Most legions have, when you go and build your units, a lot of them would have little bits of, we're going to call it, I'll call it flair, that you can put on your models when you build them. It comes from the Ultramarines.
The minimum flair era. On your armor, John. Yeah.
At tchotchkes?
Yes.
Although it's always going to go with shenanigans. Swear to God, I'm going to pistol whip next person says shenanigans.
Hey, what's that place called down the road?
Shenanigans? You mean shenanigans? Sorry.
I like a lot of the original Ultramarines. We just got done talking about 4th edition in one of our other casts. Back in the day, and there's still in a lot of the models that they have right now, the Ultramarines have, if you want to go with it, a ton of flair. In the models, you can...
On the models. When we say flair, Brad means literally, if you painted the models, you put them on the board, every model looked different. And I could not agree more. It looks awesome. Because from a distance, they look like a sea of blue with some white, whatever. Then you get close to them and you realize every model is a little bit different. And visually, from an artistic standpoint, it really breaks it up really well. And so that all... This is something that exists in modern 40K, and the way that was introduced to it was through the lore of the Ultramarines.
You're giving out stickers. Ultramarines give out the most stickers.
Yeah, exactly. However, after 30 years into the Great Crusade, the 13th Legion took their greatest challenge and actually their first real loss and had a massive effect on the Legion and their legacy. So this was called the Osiris Rebellion. Great Crusade is expanding and things are going really well. The Emperor and the Legion are just quickly pacifying the stars and making incredible gains in the galaxy. Most worlds actually were accepting Imperial compliance, and those that didn't were taught a very hard and fast lesson. More importantly, at this stage, there weren't a lot of worlds who would accept compliance and later go into rebellion. It was rare. They also had the Night Lords, which made that even rarer once it started happening.
If you weren't Xenos and you weren't full chaosing done, and they hadn't really reached any of these yet, most everybody was pacified pretty quickly, and they had a lot of W's in the early parts of the Crusade because they just didn't meet, unless you were the Dark Angels having to go against some crazy stuff and other space wolves who were sent to pound on something. You kind of were fed layups a lot. They were cherry picking a lot of wins here. They went into, and the Osiris Rebellion isn't an individual place. It's the Osiris Cluster. There was a ton of 11 star systems that are known in there. So this is a large place. And all of a sudden you had a complete, it wasn't even a cutoff of communication. It was just vessels being seized, naval vessels being attacked and losing control, not even contact, but control of entire sectors out of nowhere.
And what's really important about this sector didn't resist Imperial compliance. When the Emperor came in, it was actually bloodless. They signed over and signed a treaty and were super happy. This was actually viewed as a very reliable sector, but also a very important sector. I think it had at least 2 hive worlds in it, a lot of raw materials, a lot of this stuff. So when the Osiris, and we say rebellion, Brad's hinted at there, but I want to dive home. There's levels to rebellion in this era. Most rebellions you hear about are, I'm not paying my Imperial tithe rebellion. Or I want to renegotiate my Imperial tithe rebellion. This was, they fired upon Imperial naval vessels, totally different, and murdered every Imperial agent on the planets.
Yep.
So immediately what the Imperium does is they blockade off the cluster. The closest group to this was the Ultramarines, and their Lord Commander is a guy named Gren Vasotho. They say to him, fix this. So he looks at this and he assumes the rebellion, like any rebellion that had happened to him, was just some overly ambitious nobility, assuming that because his viewpoint is that these guys assumed that the Emperor and the legions were far enough away that they wouldn't come back.
And also, it was known that the Crusade was going that away and they didn't want to come back, which they actually didn't want to come back. So you did get away with a little bit of this, because if you could just wait out the Marines, you could usually negotiate a smidge with the Imperial agents that were sent to you to talk
about. Yeah, you might be able to get that tithe down from 20% to 18, type maneuver. So Vasotho decides that this is a nothing thing, and I'm going to do a tactic that actually they call out as being one they learned from Horus, which was this cutting off the head of the snake method. Rather than doing a protracted battle that just sacks a lot of worlds and costs a lot of thing, you figure out where is the leader, And then you go there real fast and you kill them. Because once they're dead, the rebellion usually is being fueled by them. And so this is a really good idea. The problem is that he was wrong. And he's going to discover hard way.
I feel like saying he was wrong, selling that wildly short.
Well, he was grossly misinformed as what was really going on because no one knew what was going on. And went this entire plan, if he'd known what was really happening, he would have not done it. But he didn't. And so he did. Yeah, exactly. So in order to pull this off, the problem is the 13th Legion had to deploy really aggressively and really fast, which means they had to leave all their support vessels behind because they're a lot slower and much less armored because they're going to literally jump in.
All I'm saying is when you're playing 40K, this is what's called overextending. And you get punished for it.
Well, very much so. So because of this, the way it's set up is there are defenders and they have orbital platforms so they can fire. So all he can really, if he wants to go hard and fast, he has to come in with just the Ultramarines cruisers, for lack of a better description here. They can take some of the beating and they can give it out and they move fast enough that they can avoid a lot of the firepower. So that's the idea. We're going to go in there basically just with Space Marines. We're going to land on this main hive world. We're going to go in there and we're going to find the dude or people in charge and murder them. No problem.
And then it'll be done deal.
Yeah.
Clap, no clap, out of here.
Yeah. Round one goes great. They get into orbit. They blow up all the defensive satellites. They don't take a single casualty. They then prepare. They begin an orbital bombardment of the planet, taking out all of the planetary main defenses. So all of the main fortresses, all the local guns, etc. And then they deploy down to the planet. At which point, everything goes sideways.
Well, because everyone decided they blew up our planetary defenses. And I took offense to that. And who did? Everyone. Apparently, they were handing out 2-for-1 bat sale because every single person on the planet just decided they were going to pick up a stick with a nail in it and start running at people.
And that is, in effect, what happens. They land on the planet, and there is a horde of people waiting for them there. And this just sea of people, it's the Jam the Wood Shepherd style. It's the same thing that we ended up doing, the Imperium ended up doing against the Attack Moon.
I got you on this one, John.
I'm coming over on a Team Imperium. It's fine. I look much more like Imperium than anything else in the game. But yeah, so they begin actually just charging at the Space Marines over and over again. And what should have been a walk in the park becomes a slow trot. It's still going fine for the Space Marines because it's throngs of people who are wearing, you know, a toga. It's against a Space Marine. They're just killing them, but it takes longer.
Yeah. Watch Secret Level and you'll see what happens when regular dudes go against Space Marines.
Because again, this is, by the way, in the lore, not in the tabletop. In the lore, a Space Marine against regular dudes, it slows them down. Sure, he will kill them all. On the tabletop, I'll bet on the guardsmen 9 times out of 10. Yeah, I've seen those dice rolls.
Hope you can roll a bunch of 3-ups.
Yeah. But eventually, the 13th Legion succeed, and they get to the main hive, which is the true source of the rebellion. However, this is not a planetary governor, but instead dirty, stinky, filthy Xenos. Out of nowhere, ships that are described as having an hourglass shape that rotates come out of the sun where they've been hiding and start attacking. They've been hiding away. They start blowing up and attacking the ships in orbit. At the same time, the Space Marines have been fighting through the populace. No, they've been fighting through a portion of the populace. The rest of the populace now comes out and starts just basically jumping on them to pull them down. And then they see the Xenos, who are described as being partially ethereal in form and then wearing Baroque biomechanical suits, which I took to mean steampunk, but GW didn't want to get sued. Although I will admit steampunk is technically Victorian, but Baroque, Victorian.
Steampunk looks cool as crap. You don't talk bad about steampunk.
Oh, no, I'm not talking about steampunk. What I'm saying is when GW described it as Baroque is it's interesting because there's nothing industrial in Baroque. So I'm not really,
You're not close enough for me to throw stuff at you right now. Stop trying to take the fun out of it with real logic about things.
Oh, you want to say fun things about things? You know what my mother has? A master's degree in art history. You know how many art museums I got drugged to at 7 years old? All of them. So yes, yeah, sorry, the knowledge is in there. We're going through this. Anyway, as this is occurring, Vasotho is an ultramarine, so he is a tactical genius, and he realizes this battle is lost. He calls for a full immediate retreat and orders basically orbital bombardments to cover their retreat.
I love everything about this because he just goes, well, these guys are rebelling, probably being mind controlled by these Xenos, but I got to get my guys out of here. So let's just kill a few million people with just orbital bombardments and strafing runs so we can get everybody loaded up on some Thunderhawks and back out of here.
But what happens? Exactly all those things. A bunch of strafing runs, orbital bombardments, and a large section of the Legion does escape. Vasotho himself does stay behind to continue firing as the last ship departs, because that's what you do when you're a hero. And he dies. The remainder of the 13th Legion then depart, and they retreat back to where the blockade was set up around. What's interesting is that shortly thereafter, the Imperium launches a second invasion, this time with a full solar armada, the 18th Legion, and the 13th Legion. So the Salamanders would become the Salamanders and the 13th Legion. And they come in there, guns blazing, only to discover all the planets are basically empty.
Well, they all laid down. Serenity.
That is exactly that scene with Serenity, now that they describe it. I forgot about that. And what they found was that there's just dead humans everywhere who just laid down and died. But two interesting pieces. One, the numbers didn't quite add up. There are millions of missing people.
Implying
that they were taken with them by the Xenos, because obviously the Xenos are missing too. And the few humans that still hadn't starved to death, they were, of course, plugged into a machine to check their memories, completely wiped. There's no evidence whatsoever of what happened.
And they also had no ability to do anything. They were just drooling. They went factory reset, just take it back to zero.
And in the aftermath of this, the Imperium starts looking back into it. And they realize the Xenos were a massive threat to the galaxy. Now called the Osirian Cybreeds, they were a super psyker species that could enthrall massive populations and utilize them for their own gains. And when they started looking at the records for the whole region, they realized the Osirians had been there for a while, fomenting small rebellions all over the place and just creating strife and problems for the Imperium. We're going to leave the Osirians now. We're coming back to them at the end of the cast, but let's just say all Space Marines can hold a grudge, and the Ultramarines are not above that.
Yeah. Yeah. Say, you don't hear a lot about the Osirians anymore, but
yeah, they didn't make it. Spoiler alert. They didn't make it to the 32nd millennia. Or the 31st, technically. So because of the failure of the Osirian rebellion, the 13th Legion actually fell into almost a state of malaise. This is their first real loss of the Crusade, and it was a big one.
Same thing with
the Ragdan, with the Dark Angels.
Yeah, exactly. I think they got a little bit of the same because of the fact they didn't just take a loss. They got first round KO'd. They got crushed. I mean, they got duped. No, this is the thing. These tactical geniuses. We always know the right plan. They got duped. They also were known for not giving collateral damage, and instead they obliterated the populace and were also 100% success on getting the people back, because everybody dies. They get nothing from that. So they get wrecked. Not only did they lose, they got duped, and all loyal Imperial citizens, zero of them were saved. So we lost every single piece. So it was just a devastating loss. It wasn't just we lost a hard-fought battle. No, you got shellacked, and you lost, and you gained. No objectives were achieved in this.
Yeah. Now, what I will laugh about is what happens next. This is what I'm going to tell you next is canon, and I hope you'll appreciate how much GW loves the Ultramarines. So they had this moment of failure. All of the pieces of Ultraman Legion begin to endeavor for more and more combat. They're going to show off that they're not a failure, they're a success. And in this period of time, they start winning conflict after conflict after conflict in an effort to prove their worthiness. They actually were almost better for the Imperium.
I was about to say,
post this.
Yeah, it was also, they weren't just winning like brutal battles. They were winning in the debate club, because they put more people under Imperial decree than anybody else at this time. And they were doing it by diplomacy and the show of force as opposed to the battle.
Yeah. So they were amazing, but they were sad. And they were also sad because at this stage, other Primarchs had been discovered and theirs hadn't yet. So obviously, as if every one of these casts we've done, you guys know what we're doing now. Now we're going to jump over to Gilliman, 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 Gilliman. I'm going to try and avoid getting the vapors here as I start covering Gilliman.
For just a second, I will stop calling him Bobby G, and I will refer to him as Reboot Gilliman.
Reboot
Gilliman.
Yeah, Gilliman. We'll cover that name in a second, guys. Don't worry. I'm not going to let that one pass. But like all Primarchs, Gilliman was stolen while in his gestation tube and warped across the galaxy in effort to be tempted by chaos. Now, this next bit here is my opinion, but I think I'm right. I think Gilliman was tempted with success and superiority. He, given the chance to show how good a ruler he was, the Chaos's viewpoint is he would therefore not respect or kowtow to the Emperor, who's kind of a jackass, if we're being honest, fomenting dissent within him and then turning him against the Emperor, which was a nice plan. But Reboot Gilliman is, we're talking about Reboot Gilliman, guys. He's not going to be a traitor. Like, he's not falling for your tricks. He's not that vain. So anyway, the story of Reboot is actually, and McCraig, is kind of interesting. So as a child, he's sent to McCraig, which is on the eastern fringe of the galaxy, also known as the right side of the galaxy. Just saying. It's the right side. So McCraig is the capital world in a star system with a decaying star, which that decaying star matters a lot more later, not initially. What's important about it is that they did pretty well through the Dark Age of Technology. They retained.
Let's talk about this. Bobby G got sent to a pretty awesome, not just world, but full system that's still trading with one another.
Bobby G's setup wasn't that bad. I'm willing to admit he may have. This is, I might be rooting for the trust fund baby of the Primarchs.
I was just about to say, he did so well with daddy's money. It was a tough time that I only had two Mercedes-Benz.
What is it? Is it the, no, it's Anchorman 2, where the guy is, I took the $100 million from my father, and after 5 years of hard work and toil, self-made. It's $101 million.
We'll be right back after a quick break.
You know that feeling when your day finally slows down and you just want to relax, unplug, and feel good? That's where Mood.com comes in. They're changing the game, delivering legal THC products right to your door, no shady dealers, and absolutely no medical card required, just good vibes and better sleep, shipped straight from their farm to your couch. From delicious THC gummies, smooth vape pens, to premium THC flower, Mood has it all. And everything's federally legal under the 2018 Farm Bill. Yeah, this isn't some loophole. It's the real deal. Head to Mood.com and use code FIRST20 for 20% off your first order. That's MOOD.com. Find your mood.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
But anyway, let me enjoy my Bobby G. So McCraig, as a system, still has warp travel ships available to it. So they've been trading across the whole area. They're basically a mini Imperium. And McCraig is run by what is I would describe as a post-Magna Carta England, in that you had a ruler called a consul who shared his power amongst the nobility class. And then beneath them, with no power to speak of whatsoever, was everybody else. So it's a not quite Magna Carta king, but closest one I can think of. And the story of Gilliman is good, but also a little hilarious in the way GW handles it, because they just randomly do stuff. And they're like, oh yeah, and then that's normal. So the first thing to start off with is a bunch of hunters are in the forest and they come across his capsule. And inside it, they find a beautiful baby. GW's words, by the way, beautiful baby. A little bit weird. I have a child. My friends have children. I have nephews. I have nieces. I have all these things. They're not beautiful, man.
All I'm saying is, in my mind, it was like he showed up like Boss Baby in the suit with a briefcase.
Yeah. It might as well be. So then they take the baby in front of the console of McCraig named Connor, which is spelled incorrectly. K-O-N-O-R. Don't know why, but Connor. Gilliman is his last name. And who I guess had been having dreams about the Emperor. Not like he didn't know the Emperor, but dreams about it, which again, you can read that however you want. You can read it the way GW wrote it, which is a foreshadow of events. An important thing was happening. Or you can laugh and think of some more hilarious ways you could be dreaming of the Emperor and just enjoy it. Because that's, of course, what my weird brain did. Anyway, upon looking at this very beautiful baby, Connor adopts him as his son. In which something GW writes, a manner not uncommon for their culture.
Yeah, like how often are you finding babies in the woods?
Yes, yeah, apparently it's common in...
Enough, yeah.
Yeah, in McCraig, in the culture of the people of McCraig, if you find a random baby in the woods, you adopt it. To be fair, that's better than what they did on Ball, which was murder the random baby you find. So they're better people, but still weird. Oh, then he names him Rabute. Because now this way we have a misspelled Connor and a messed up version of Robert.
Well, let's talk about the fact that Bobby G makes some pretty good gains in the first couple of years.
Oh, this is hilarious. Yeah, the next piece of it, at 10 years old, Gilliman runs out of things to do because he's read every book and learned everything that there is to know in all of McCraig. And memorized all of it. So at that point, they put him in charge of the military.
Yeah, he's 10. They're like... Hey, what's the next best thing for you to do? Why don't you just run the military, man? He is 10 and gigantic because he's a
prime. Yeah, I did see a funny meme the other day where it was a picture from some like 80s sci-fi movie where the child's 11 feet tall and they're like, look, a Primarch. That's basically what this was. And also, I think the Primarchs at 10 may have been shaving. Like let's call a spade here. But Gilliman takes said military and he goes to the north of McCraig where there were outcasts. And these outcasts were raiding and pillaging the, quote, civilized lands of McCraig. And they had resisted all prior campaigns in the area to quell them. Because, the people who still had space travel and weapons from the Golden Age of technology couldn't handle rebels in the mountain.
Yeah, I don't know. I like this writing on this.
Red Dawn.
Let's talk about what happens, though.
Gilliman, this part is cool. Yeah.
Conquers them, but, quote, I'm doing air quotes, even though no one can see me. They won their respect. And I'm going to bring it back to if a 10-year-old shows up and pummels everybody that I'm with, I'm going to have to give him some props. He's going to get my respect, man. Yeah. I just got beaten up by a child.
And I also want to point out, you know what no one else did? None of the other Primarchs did? This. All the rest of the Primarchs, I conquered the area. Gilliman went up to the north with an army and came back with a larger army. Pretty good deal. Now, the truth is what he ended up doing is really cool. This is why Gilliman is actually awesome. So when he got up there, he challenged the leader of the rebels to a duel. And in the entire duel, he never attacked. He just dodged until the leader fell over with exhaustion. Yeah. Then after he's lying there exhausted, Gilliman presents him with a gift. And the gift is Gilliman learned in all of his reading that the reason the rebels were upset was that the nobles of McCraig had stolen some sacred artifact. They never say what it is, but some sacred artifact
brought it from with him. Those particular people.
He brought it with them and he handed it over to them as a way, as a peace offering. And I want to point out,
go ahead.
But this was written by British people, which is either incredibly self-aware or incredibly ironic. And I don't know
go to the British Museum and get one of your things back.
But
also
Cleopatra. They have Cleopatra.
I have to give again talking about getting beat up by a 10-year-old because he just weaves and doesn't do anything. He just doesn't let him hit him. He doesn't need to do that though. He could have led with the artifact.
Oh yeah. Oh, he could open with "I brought you something. Like, I will challenge you to a duel."
Yeah, you're like none of. He didn't have to do any of these things. Yeah. He just made exhausted. That guy sad, and then went, "Oh yeah, I brought this too. Come on, let's go back." And he's, "I guess," but also. what was the whole duel thing for, man? Yeah, not cool.
Why did you have to? Yeah, right. You're right. Because he did it in front of all of his friends. You're right. It didn't occur to me that he just said that in front of all of his friends.
Everybody
just makes everyone go, so our leader's kind of a bitch.
Yeah. Remember the time that our leader got beat up by a 10-year-old? Yeah. Couldn't land a blow on him. And then it looked like the guy got bored. And then went, oh, yeah, here, I feel bad for you. Here's your
artifact. Leader spent so much time missing punching a 10-year-old that he fell over with exhaustion.
Yeah, that's what
happened. Maybe he shouldn't. Yeah, maybe. I guess it doesn't.
I don't think he's. I definitely guarantee they were like, whoever you say is our new leader is our new leader, because this dude is for sure out.
At that point, Gilliman goes back to the capital of McCraig. And upon getting back to the capital, he finds it besieged from within. Turns out one of the other consuls to his father had betrayed him, was leading a coup. There's a lot of details in this coup. There's a drunken mob at one point. I don't love it, but I like the bit that they get to. So Galen, who was a member of the McCraig nobility, and it turns out that the nobility had a pretty good life until Gilliman's dad arrived, because McCraig was built on slave labor. And Connor Gilliman wanted to get rid of all the slaves and wanted to make the people equals. And this was sentiment shared by Gilliman. And this other guy, Galen, felt differently. And this, by the way, goes real fast in the books, but it's just funny. Gilliman and his army go to the capital.
Hold on. Because you're going to tell Gilliman and the guys and his group put down the rebellion, which is a huge understatement, because they strung all the rebels up in the streets.
Yeah, and separated them because, again, like any good Excel spreadsheet, proper spacing between them, and just hung them all from the streets.
Yeah.
Gilliman arrives to run solo, which really isn't hard when you're a Primarch. Remember, these are all regular people. Runs solo to the capital, which is actually in ruins. And he pulls through the ruins and finds his dying father. The plot, this is so just dramatic of a scene. And his father on his dying breath, and by breath, it's like a paragraph he gives out, details to Gilliman who betrayed him, why he betrayed him, who the assassin was that tried to kill him, and all these
things.
This is
full Shakespeare on this. He does the whole... Yeah. Avenge me, but also make everything better for the populace of McCraig.
Yeah.
But also remember to avenge me. I want to go back to that one more time.
Yeah. So Gilliman goes full early Robespierre, not late or middle Robespierre, but early Robespierre, and just wrecks shop. He immediately grabs all the other nobles, executes all of them, takes all the inherited titles, all their positions, and redistributes it throughout the entire populace. And turns McCraig into a meritocracy. Or Brad, as the macho man would say,
he rises to the top.
Yeah, that is a C. Rises to the top, a C. He builds what I would like to call the macho man society. Not the YMCA version or Village People version. Anyway, so shortly after this, the emperor arrives in the system, but on another planet. And on this planet, he hears all the stories of what's happened on McCraig about how this orphan from the woods, by the way, there's a bunch of orphans from the woods. It's like the theme throughout the Primarchs, has turned this entire planet around. And the emperor is super excited and heads over to McCraig to go pick up his son. But the gods of chaos throw one last ditch effort in to try and mess this system up. And the emperor gets stuck in a warp storm for 5 years, or at least 5 years real time. Who knows about the warp time?
Could have been five
and when
seconds.
He arrives, yeah, Gilliman has now been in charge for 5 years. And Gilliman has done a lot.
He's now completely taking over, rewritten the laws of the entire sector, which he is now, I guess, basically he is the emperor of this.
He's now the emperor of what becomes known as Ultramar.
And it completely changed everything. The emperor shows up to this system that is working. If anything, no one was more successful before the emperor found them than Gilliman. Yeah. Not even close.
Ultramar is hands down the most successful region in the galaxy at this
still
stage.
Is. It might still be. Yeah.
They've been attacked a bunch of times, but I think probably still is. Yeah.
It's just he comes and he finds that he's got things running on clockwork, because if anything that you don't like about Bobby G, you know what happens? Things show up on time. They're running like a fine oiled machine. And also, he's got wild, you have to say he has fairness in here. People are treated
The people of Ultramar are doing great. I would also argue joining the Imperium is the worst thing that ever happened to Ultramar. Anyway.
Oh, for sure. Before the Emperor showed up, Ultramar was a pretty great place for everyone. And then they got mobilized for war and things did not.
It's still better than all the other recruiting worlds.
But
one of those worlds is Necromunda. So
yeah, I was going to say this system now is not great.
Even with all his success, as soon as Gilliman meets the Emperor, he immediately declares his fealty to him, which, by the way, it occurred to us writing this, that's really weird thing to do when you meet your dad. See, the first time you meet your dad, if you've never met your dad, the first thing you do when you meet him is declare fealty to him. That's probably why you've never met your dad before, and you should probably not ever meet him again. Just good life rule.
Yeah, but I do the fact that they go through the fact that Bobby G ran through a million different potentials of this and then decided that he was worthy of his fealty after he ran through everything. Just in that
He analyzed the Emperor. And the Emperor looks at Gilliman and just goes, here, and gives him the 13th Legion. And then he goes, all right, do stuff with this. And Gilliman does stuff. My favorite part of really this whole thing, and Brad and I are going to fight now, is deal with it is true. I think Brad's wrong about Vulcan being the only good guy in 40K for two reasons. One, I think Gilliman is a lawful good paladin. And second, I don't think Vulcan is, because Vulcan committed a war crime and Gilliman didn't.
Gilliman has done a lot of stuff to get...
Really? Did he get angry and burn an entire planet full of people?
No, but he has whacked sectors to make sure that for the greater good, basically.
It is for the greater good, but not because that sector made him angry.
Well, they shouldn't have talked so much shit.
I'm glad that Vulcan was sorry afterwards, but I just...
He did change his life around after it.
Yeah, neat. So lots of people do that when they're on death row in prison. They still murdered all those people.
No one was going to testify against him. There wasn't anybody left there.
That is actually a fair point. There's not a lot of evidence there. Anyway.
He's not going to jail anytime soon.
My opinion is I think Gilliman is possibly the goodest guy in the galaxy for the Imperium.
He's the most the goodiest.
Yeah, the goodest guy. Because I mean, he's not good. He's just the goodest. That's the most important there.
I would say that he would be, if you're going alignment, he could be a lawful good paladin that has the parentheses neutral afterwards because he's willing to do what has to be done to save the most amount of people. He's very pragmatic, very pragmatic. Yeah,
that's why I think he's lawful because he's following the law of...
I'll give you law, but I think he probably skews... The longer he goes, the more he goes towards neutrality because sometimes you got to make a planet not exist anymore so the Tyranids don't get more supplies. Things that Bobby G has done.
But he did evacuate most of those planets whenever possible.
I like the key word would be most.
Most, yeah. All right, but anyway, back to Gilliman of the 13th Legion. They set out to the galaxy, and not simply to conquer it, but to actually increase the size and scope of the Imperium through efficiency and planning. Tremar, the system, is turned into a recruiting world, which immediately starts pouring recruits into the Ultramarines, more so than any other Legion. More on that later, guys, because there may be a little bump they got there. But what's important is as the Ultramarines conquered new planets and systems, they copied the Ultramar system. Planets were not added to the fold and told, all right, figure it out.
I think this, I'm going to give my big deal for the cast on this one. This is the biggest deal about early Ultramarines because they didn't conquer, roll out, and throw random Ted, the Imperial governor, and say, figure it out. They made new Ultramars everywhere they went. They rebuilt, they restructured, they showed them, they added technology, they immediately gave them trade routes. That's one of the big things they write about is they add them to existing trade that's already happening. So you have all of the goods, food, agriculture, everything that you would need, and they show you how to use it before they leave. And they're so efficient about this that they actually don't lose time in conquering new worlds, even though they're doing this. For instance, you go into Lorgar, who kept setting up idols to the Emperor, and he got in trouble because he was so slow in continuing the crusade.
Yeah, no, the Ultramarines did quick. Another one that I do want to point out that he did that was, that I think is important, is he did enact a lot of regime change. A lot of it. Gilliman and the Ultramans got to a planet where they found, much like what was going on McCreg, where we had planetary governors or rulers who were using slaves, who were doing stuff like that, they would just remove them. Wow. Which is why I think one of the many reasons when Gilliman arrived back on Terra in like M41, the Lords of Terra were not thrilled to see him, because he has kind of a history of people like them not doing well.
If you're abusing the people underneath you, you're about to get punted into the sun.
But what happens is, over the remainder of this Great Crusade, the Ultramans end up conquering more worlds than any other legion by a wide margin. And it's because Gilliman was so skilled at war, but also knew that it had a time and a place. Whereas all of his brothers, except for maybe Magnus, favored these displays of might, Gilliman knew that conflict just bred more conflict.
Well, one of the biggest things about this, like, the systems that the Ultramarines conquered stayed conquered and loyal in a wildly better percentage than any other legion, because he set that groundwork. And you could say the Ultramarines are boring, blah, 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 whatever. They do get the job done, and they keep it done.
That's the thing, because when you say get the job done, the implication is, they achieved it. No, they got the job done and got all stars, 5-star reviews. You know,
well, happy to have been conquered by the Ultramarines in the end. The populace loves the Ultramarines when they leave. Most of the time.
And this is because Gilliman really did avoid conflict unless it was necessary. He had a great line where he said, the loss of each legionary weakened the whole of the legion. So he really did only use conflict when he had to use conflict. And so he pulled, to Brad's point, all these bloodless victories. So these worlds are just coming over, joining the Imperium. And because of what the Ultramarines do, they don't have to spend as much time now on war. They now spend their entire time on setting the world up for success. So to his Brad's point earlier, they're still off world pretty quickly, but they leave a world that's prosperous, safe, and growing. And this is kind of what ends up happening, is word starts to spread. They don't have to show up like some of the other legions, where they have the snarling world eaters with them. If you don't listen, I'm going to let them down on the planet. They just basically say, hey, here's a video of the last 7 planets we went. Basically show like with their references. Yeah. Here are references of prior systems we've conquered.
Here's my Yelp reviews. Saying, look at all these. Exactly. They're glowing.
5 stars. Fun. No bots. 5 stars. Yeah.
And so it's really good at this. And I do think the fact that while Bobby G's superpower is he's effectively the best tactical bureaucrat in the galaxy, but it does make it so he also didn't have the same, I need to show Dad how awesome I was, because I don't think he's as big of a true believer as Dorne. Like Dorne, for instance, was a believer in the Imperial Doctrine. I think Bobby G really wanted to make the Imperium work. And I think this is how it was going to be the best.
You know, after we did our Cypher cast, I think Bobby G has more aligned with Cypher than really most anyone else, where Bobby G wanted humanity to succeed. He wanted people to do well. That's what he cared about. And he saw within the Emperor a way to make that happen. Whereas I think most other Primarchs saw humanity as weak.
100%.
And Gilliman probably still does. But he views it as a protector, like when we cover the Knight cast and some of that nobility. Even the Lion has this in him as well, to a point, although he's a grouch. But
it's his job. He feels that it's his job, but he looks at it in a grander way, which is, I'm in charge of all of humanity. How am I going to make all of humanity work?
I want all of humanity to prosper, et cetera. Now, I will say one thing that we need to get out of the way, and this is the best place to do it, is the Ultramarines are really large. When we talk about large, just for number's sake, leading up to the Horus Heresy, the Ultramarines were listed at 250,000. So 250,000 Marines. Not Marines and support.
No, just Marines.
That puts them 50,000 over second place, which is the Dark Angels. So 25% larger than the second largest. For reference, Raven Guard, Death Guard, Salamanders, Thousand Suns, White Scars were barely a third the size of the Ultramarines. The Ultramarines themselves, I did some math on this, guys, make up over 8% of all Space Marines. Now, how did they get this big? And I love this in the writing. So it was hinted it might have something to do with the two missing Primarchs. And this, by the way, is canon. So the Emperor went into the galaxy, as we said before. He had 20 full
legions of space
100,000. Yeah. Each of these legions had shared a gene seed with a yet-to-be-discovered Primarch. Only 18 of those Primarchs are, heavy air quotes here, discovered, or I'll go with the word recovered. It's probably a better one.
Yeah.
We have no idea what happened to the two. There's no writings on them. GW's never done anything with them. But given the power of a Primarch, they're redacted when they list them, though. Exactly. But what I want to point out is, given the power of a Primarch, it's not like they landed in the woods and got eaten by a wolf. Like, they were most likely destroyed by the Emperor when he discovered them, because they'd likely fall into chaos.
Well, again, chaos tried to corrupt all of them to different, different ways. Different. They put different trials on each one. They threw them. None of them went to somewhere. Well, besides this, none of them went to somewhere super easy.
Hey, there were challenges on McCraig. I mean,
there was no challenges. This is the Bobby G is the nepotism baby of all time.
On his sweet 16, was he going to do the Range Rover? Was he going to do the BMW 6 Series? It was a tough life for Bobby G. I don't know why you're being so mean.
Yeah.
But yeah, the two missing are most likely killed by Valdor, who, fun side note on Constantine Valdor, he wanted to murder all of the Primarchs as soon as they went missing. That was his immediate thought. Like,
yeah, because he said they got taken by chaos. Kill him.
Yeah, all right, I'll go. I got my knife. I'll be back in whenever.
He's also going to kill Mom because of it too. So,
yeah, there was a lot of murder. I'm a fan, but
he was like, "Well, this project went wrong. Let's just kill them."
Yeah, Constantine Valdor is hilarious if you read him right in the lore. He's horrible, but if you read him a certain way, it's funny. But anyway, after disposing of the Primarchs, the Emperor has a choice, and his choice was destroy the entire legions. But that feels kind of like a bit of a waste, because these are all Terran-born with just a little bit of other guy's gene seed. And so he decides to do something that is not fan fiction. This is in the books. He folds them into the Ultramarines.
Yeah.
It's a few different books it's hidden in, but basically they use the guise of the Ultramar providing endless recruits as a cover story. But in reality, they were actually folded in. There's conversations between Magnus and Lorgar. There's a conversation between Dorn and Malkador. These are in separate books where the Emperor has wiped from their memories the actual Primarchs themselves, but they know little bits and pieces. And there's a lot of comments made through a few different books about the incredible size of the Ultramarines.
Well, they talk about the fact, one of the comments is one of the times when the Ultramarines take huge losses, but they still have
250,000
Ultramarines. Yeah. And they're like, wait a minute, didn't they just take horrific losses here? You're like, but whatever.
So the last bit we're going to cover on the cast is going back to the loss earlier, with the loss of the Osirians. So we never foreshadowed that far. See, Ultramarines had proven themselves great conquerors of human settlements time and time over, bloodless campaigns, etc. But Ultramar does also sit on the eastern right side of the galaxy. This is an area that the Eldar weren't that prevalent in, which means there's a lot of pretty advanced Xenos out there. As a result, because we spend a lot of time there talking about how good the Ultramarines are at bringing planets into the fold, they were also really good at killing Xenos. They were masters of tactical warfare. And, you know, what they were really good at is actually utilizing adaptive warfare. So some people were good at lightning drop assaults, space wolves, other protracted sieges, covert ops, obviously, whatever you want to call what the world leaders do is, but they all had their thing. The Ultramarines were masters of adapting their tactics midway through. So they would go in with a great battle plan that 99% of the time would work. But if it didn't, they would take them, when I say a moment, I'm talking milliseconds here, diagnose why it's not working, find the weakness in the enemy, counterattack. That's always what the Ultramarines do.
In the game, I just want to throw this in for the game, because Ultramarines were the only people that used to be able to combat squad, because they could adapt their tactics. That was the whole thing, is that they were adapting to whatever they saw on the battlefield.
Yeah. And so what happens is the Ultramarines, this is a really great tactic when you're going up against orcs and the endlessly unnamed species of the galaxy, because they don't exist anymore, thanks to the Ultramarines. But upon taking over the Legion, Gilliman had read about what happened with those Cybrids. Gilliman didn't really care about the lost honor of his chapter, because they more than earned it back at this point. He was more concerned about these Cybrids, because he decided they presented a massive threat to humanity.
This is why Bobby G is neutral, because when Bobby G decides somebody could do bad in the future, he decides they no longer need to exist, which is what he does here.
Yeah, but it's also...
he's not okay. Wrong, but yes, I'm just
Zeno,
saying.
So he's okay. You're not going to win this one. He's better than Vulcan. Just deal with it. He's not as cool as Vulcan. Actually, yeah, he is. All right. So with the whole time that the Ultramarines are spreading through the galaxy, kind of the same way the Dark Angels were always looking for evidence of the Fallen, Gilliman was always on the lookout for the Osirian. He'd find hints of their existence, but the trails had all gone cold. It's rogue traders about massacres or large disappearances, rebellions on entire planets, just where everyone's wiped out to a man, all of that. But they were always post. You couldn't find anything about the Osirian's location until 899 of M30. In 899 of M30, Gilliman and the Ultramarines get word that the 12th Legion is in trouble.
Also, it's the 12th Legion pre-Angron, so it's still the Warhounds. And also, again, Primarchless. So all the Legions just operate better once they get their Primarch.
Exactly. Gilliman heads to the system and finds this entire area with an insane amount of destruction. The space is littered with debris from destroyed craft. They go planet side and recover the Warhounds, what few of them were left of them, and start talking about what happened here. And they find out the Warhounds had been sent to a region to engage an orc force. While fighting the orcs, this other Xenos appeared in system with spinning hourglass
ships. Ships.
Yep. And obviously it's the Osirians. The Osirians then actually thralled these orcs that the Warhounds were fighting against.
Which shows you that they're pretty badass psykers at this point in time.
Yeah,
to take over the orcs, yeah.
Yeah, and then they turned the orcs against the Warhounds while at the same time going down to the human colony that was there and actually enthralling them. This area, by the way, is called the Eurydice Terminal, for the record. However, while they were doing this, a bunch of other orcs show up. Having sensed a battle, the Glortian Empire... because they were led by the war boss, Glort.
Glort.
I like.
Because why
I
not?
Like Glort. Who, by the way, are still a playable faction in modern 40K. They are a freebooter fleet.
That is true.
But they still do exist. The Glorts, upon arrival, because there's a lot more of them, are able to resist the psychic powers of the Osirians. And then just decide, orcs are going to orc. There's a fight to be had. We're having the fight. So the Glort orcs attack the Osirian thralled orcs plus the Osirians plus the planet. And now you've got this whole sector is on fire.
Hey, hold on. This part is dumb because the guy that's the ultimate tactical mind decides that he doesn't need reinforcements because he needs to have his legion redeem themselves on crushing them. I'm like, no, he would for sure admit, oh yeah, you guys can come along because it would be great to have reinforcements.
Yeah, no, Gilliman refuses the offer of the Warhounds to join them and says, no, we're going to do this solo. And I like what he does next. Gilliman takes him a moment and surveys the battlefield and surveys the situation and realizes pretty quickly that the only way to achieve victory against the Osirian is to do a head-on fast assault. And he realizes this because of what he's looking at, but also what happened the last time they fought the Osirians, where the Osirians just will throw endless chaff at you. And while you're trying to chew your way and fight through that chaff, their capital ships, by the way, are larger than the Imperial ships.
And their weaponry was said to be more powerful from a distance.
So it would have easily picked the Ultramarine fleet apart over time. So instead, he decides to ignore all of the orcs, all of the thralled humans, and just focus on attacking the Osirians. This all, by the way, is from the Black Library book, Tempest. Battle's pretty epic, although it's actually not that many pages, but it's still a pretty cool fight.
That's what is it? So, book, we got it written.
Five.
Right?
Book five.
As usual, I was going to try to do it from memory as opposed to the notes that we have right in front of me.
Yeah, in front of your face. Yep. So the Ultramarines detect the Osirian ships behind a bunch of orc and imperial chaff, and they just beeline at them. When I say beeline at them, I don't mean engage them in naval warfare. I mean, they drove up next to them and fired assault rams into them. And the assault rams are the thing, if you've seen Astartes on YouTube, which if you haven't, go look that up. It's absolutely incredible. Okay. But it's basically a torpedo full of space marines that you shoot into a ship. And when in the ship, it opens and the space marines get out immediately shooting at everything. And this is a really classic space marine tactic. They enter the vessel with a combination of regular marines behind Terminator Marines.
And Terminators are so much cooler in the lore than they are in the game, but especially when you're talking about boarding missions, because Terminators mop the floor with regular people, regular warriors, regular space marines. They mop the board with them, or floor with them. And their tactic is amazing because they're pushing forward, but the entire time they're going, they're slamming melta bombs, which is just ruining the ship. So they're destroying the parts of the ship as they're continuing on.
And they basically do this until they get to a point, either the bridge of the ship, or they just put enough melta bombs down that the ship begins to implode, at which point they teleport or just get picked up and go back. So they start doing this to the entire Osirian fleet, pulling the ships down until the capital ship of the Osirian fleet comes into view, lashing out with its macro weapons and just wrecking some ships. So at the same time this thing arrives, a bunch of enthralled orcs and humans start hurtling themselves at the Ultramarines. And as thick as these hordes of attackers are, they're not as thick as Gilliman's plot armor.
Best thing that you wrote this entire thing.
Yeah, because man, so Gilliman himself leads the assault in the capital ship. And with his retinue,
I'm proud of you.
I'm getting there, of Terminators and what is at this moment the most powerful psyker in the Legion, Ptolemy. Because every now and then GAW has to write a name really quickly and just goes, screw it, I'll use an old one. And I don't know if he means Ptolemy the Greek or Ptolemy the Roman. But either
or
way,
sure, it's homage. The Roman, because that's what the Ultramarines are based on. But continue.
But Ptolemy the Greek was with Alexander the Great.
True.
So that's why Ptolemy the Roman was a mathematician, and this is a psyker.
He's a combo. Let's just be honest.
Did I mention John was raised in the classics? It's really subtle, isn't it? It is useful now, but just God, I was a nerd as a child. I guess I'm a nerd as an adult. Who am I kidding?
What are you talking about?
Yeah, I have a lore cast. Nothing you're right. Changed. Never mind. Nothing changed. It just got cooler to be this nerdy. That's really all that changed. Thanks, universe. Anyway, as Gilliman and his crew pass into the inner sanctum, they find the king of the Osirian there. And of course, because we have plot to do here, he's three times the size of Gilliman and possessing psychic powers that would challenge Magnus, rises up to kill Gilliman and the defenders. And this next bit is written epic, but of course I read it with my silly brain, so I'm going to give you both.
Silly brain. I love the fact that he's got Ptolemy with him. You're like, is this going to be an epic battle between Gilliman and the Osirian king? Yes, but I also have to have this plot armor guy next to me so I don't just get wrecked by his psychics. Am I supposed to do anything else but make it so you can fight him? Nah, things are going to go terrible for you. But
yeah. I'm going to make some references here that I hope you guys get. So as soon as the Osirian king reaches out, all the Terminators basically fall over. They're incapacitated by psychic powers. Only Gilliman and Ptolemy are standing there to fight it. Ptolemy is using all of his psychic might to push back the power around the Osirian king so that Gilliman then charges forward with Ptolemy to fight the king. And I think when they wrote this, the best visual I can give you is in the sanctioned psyker in Secret Level, where he pops out of the thing to defend Titus and the guys against the demon. But I envision this as the show The Tick with Arthur. He was always stuck behind The Tick, which works on two levels. One, I'm accurate, and two, The Tick's blue. So this works twice. And if you haven't seen The Tick, I want to say it's good, but I haven't seen it in a very long time. But I remember laughing at it quite a bit. Yeah. And so the battle goes good and then bad. And then Gilliman gets really angry because it's not going well and cuts all the limbs off the Osirian king and pulls its glowing brain out of its skull, throws it in the ground and stomps on it with his boot, creating killing Ptolemy.
And kills Ptolemy.
And Ptolemy dies. Yeah.
Yeah. And you go, hey, man. Again, was your only point to be here just so you could protect me?
You know what? Yes. Yeah, basically, Ptolemy is the South Park Kenny of the episode.
The best part is in this book, the book is cool, don't get me wrong. and the fight's cool, but in a very few short pages, Gilliman's like, oh man, I'm gonna get defeated. Oh, what can I possibly do to win this fight? And then he just chops off all his limbs and rips his brain out. You're like, well, I guess you could do that. I mean, that seems
like an effective system. And as soon as it happens, by the way, this shuts down all the thralls. So like the whole rebellion ends right here and there, and all of the Osirians are killed. And so at this point, the important part of this battle, though, is it's after this battle from a plot and lore standpoint. This is when they start wearing the Omega crest on their armor, because Gilliman's viewpoint is this battle that they'd won had proven their superiority, and therefore they will wear the Omega, which is what we see on every single Ultramarine model to this day. With that, we're going to break, because next week we're going to pick it up from there in the lead-ups to the heresy, namely Gilliman and Lorgar not being best of friends. Actually, Gilliman, I'm going to call this out. Gilliman is an amazing judge of character, because he was friends with none of the guys who go to Chaos except for Horus, and that was a big left turn, and severely disliked all of them, actually. And his best friends were, I think, Dorne, Sanguinius, the Lion. He had a pretty solid judge of character. Have I mentioned I like Gilliman a lot? No? Well, anyway.
You know what the best part is? He didn't like Lorgar, which makes him have at least 4 points for me.
Yeah. Oh, him and Lorgar. He was just like, yeah, that guy sucks. Like,
so much.
Nope. So next week, we're going to take the Ultramarines from pre-heresy. They don't do a lot in the heresy. There's some key battles in the heresy, but obviously they're not there for the end.
Cool books. So also with Conrad Kurz.
Yeah, there's some of that stuff in there. But then we'll probably, I think the next one, we'll get to them a little bit post-heresy. And then we'll see kind of where we go from there, guys. Like, it's the issue with doing Ultramarines is we had to do them. I needed this not have this not be 20 casts, because we still have to get the Votan and a bunch of other stuff. But we probably will... we'll figure out how we go along. But with that, until next week, this has been John Barsotti and Brad Chester.
This guy.
See you guys then.
Big money on your roofing project at Menards with Owens Corning Shingles. Your roof is the first line of defense against the elements and enhances the appearance of your home's exterior. Owens Corning Duration Shingles offer ultimate protection and impressive curb appeal. Choose from 24 colors of Owens Corning Duration Shingles and transform your home today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit DiscoverSouthCarolina.com.
Lowe's knows how to get you ready for holiday hosting with up to 35% off select home decor. And get up to 35% off select major appliances. Plus, members get free delivery, haulaway, basic installation, parts, and a 2-year Lowe's protection plan when you spend $2,500 or more on select LG major appliances. Valid through 10-1. Member offer excludes Massachusetts, Maryland, Wisconsin, New Jersey, and Florida. Installed by independent contractors. Exclusions apply. See Lowe's.com for more details.